It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
He was licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
This man ate till he burst.
So he did die by eating.
Lunch Hour Reviews.
I'm tainting me.
Tainting me!
It's feeding time.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren. And we are the Rant Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rants Macabre, please visit Fangoria.com.
You're very close to your first vows, and I'm having trouble believing that you're really devoted.
I am devoted.
Dear Sweet Pea, I don't know if you're reading my emails or not, but this is the only way I know how to get in touch with you. Jacob has finally been released from the hospital in Texas and is home with your dad and I. Please, if you can come visit, let me know. Your room is the same way you left it. There's a warm, familiar bed waiting for you. Love, Mom.
So every once in a while, we get the option of a movie review for something that's outside of our general genre expectations.
Right.
I guess. And we wouldn't try and sell this particular movie as horror. It isn't.
It is not, no.
But you do have to consider it is made by horror fans, and the characters involved are horror fans themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be talking about this year's movie, Little Sister, from Zach Clark.
We were recently given the opportunity to meet with the writer, director, and editor of Little Sister, Zach Clark, and he was accompanied with executive producer Joe Swanberg. So it's kind of, that's how we kind of all get involved, because when someone says, do you want to talk to Joe Swanberg, you don't say no.
You say yes.
Yeah. You're like, yes, I do. When can I talk about The Sacrament? So we got to do an interview. We got to sit down with both of them. They are... Zach Clark is a horror fan.
Yeah.
And this is a movie about outsiders. It really is. And I think a lot of our listeners, and definitely myself included, can really associate with some of the outside behaviors.
Yeah. This story, to give the listener a sense, Little Sister is about the character Colleen, played by Addison Timlin. A familiar face from the sort of spiritual sequel to The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah.
Her character is a nun who's based in New York City and returns home upon hearing that her brother has returned from the war. He's been severely injured. He's got traumatic burns across his face, and he's got complications. And the mother's kind of asking for help because the brother is isolating himself. You know, we talk about it in the interview, but he kind of haunts the movie for the first half hour before we ever actually see him. Starting in New York City, Colleen is, I guess, at the nunnery, I'm going to call it, for lack of a better...
Yeah, call it a nunnery. She is with all the nuns because she is on the first level of becoming a nun.
Yeah, she explains the steps that... I did not grow up Catholic. I am completely unfamiliar. But she's committed. She's pot committed.
Yeah.
And her superior, this is where, you know, the cast starts to open up. Barbara Crampton plays the...
Reverend Mother.
Reverend Mother? Okay, I was going to say chief nun. I don't know shit.
Head nun. Not in charge. Yeah, she is the Reverend Mother for this particular group and this particular order. So that's the thing about this movie. It's not a horror movie, but it is made by someone who appreciates horror and by someone whose audience even appreciates it. Because you see Barbara Crampton, you're like, yee, you know, and you see Joe Swanberg's name on it, you go, yeah.
Yeah, and we found out in the interview that Zach Clark is good friends with Ted Yogan, who did We Are Still Here, which starred Barbara Crampton.
Right.
So... interested to cast her in the movie, he asked for an introduction, and so she sounds as great as we could wish her to be.
Everyone loves her.
Yeah.
When are we gonna have her on this show?
That'll be exciting. So technically it's a period piece in that it's supposed to take place in 2008, and I think on the television at the time of the story are the debates between Obama and Mitt Romney. So it plants us in this sort of transitional period where, if you remember Obama's, you know, all the campaign signage was all about change. It's time, you know, and
hope and change.
One of my favorite elements about the movie, and it's not even a direct comment, but the sort of space it occupies as an indie shot and produced outside of the major Hollywood system, especially Joe Swanberg's involvement means that it kind of a throwback to like 70s filmmaking in terms of these outsiders outside of the studio system being far more like man on the street. They're familiar with the territory. And I kind of love that, like, Joe Swanberg, his show Easy is now on Netflix, and he wrote and directed and produced, I think it's like 8 full episodes. And it's all like these self-contained things. It's right. Scenarios where actors are eager to work with him. And, you know, he talks about the process and sort of like producing and shooting and keeping productions to a bare minimum. It's we've had Roger Corman on the brain lately.
Yes.
And Joe Swanberg's output is substantial. Like, the man's making several movies every year. In the meantime, he's producing movies like this
right.
entirely outside of the studio
Occasionally,
system.
He'll act in some too. I mean,
yeah.
He's doing everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So I love that. So this movie in particular, it'll be available on iTunes and Amazon by the time you hear this. So it's totally worth checking out.
So we got to sit down and talk with Zach Clark and Joe Swanberg, and we were in a lobby of a hotel, so there is a little bit of ambiance sound, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ambiance. So you might hear that on the recording, but it was a great sit down, and kind of you couldn't have asked for an interview with two nicer people.
They were great. They were really cool.
So here is our interview.
So we're here with Zach Clark and Joe Swanberg. We're talking about the movie Little Sister. If you guys had to give your elevator pitch for the movie, like a sort of synopsis for what people can expect.
Yeah, Little Sister is about a young nun who was goth in high school, and she returns home to visit her estranged family, which includes her brother, who is a war veteran who's just gotten back from the Iraq War. The movie's set in October 2008. He's been badly burned, and their parents are sort of hippie stoners in the mountains outside of Asheville, North Carolina. So it's a political movie. It's a Halloween movie. It's a sad, sad comedy.
And you place it around 2008. I've got some guesses as to why, but I'm curious if you could talk about why you set it in 2008, specifically during the election.
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of a myriad of reasons. The biggest one, the one that was foremost in my mind writing it, is A, I think it contextualized the brother's situation a little more specifically for me than setting it present day. So okay. Setting it at the end of the Bush administration, I think, sort of pointed a little bit more to that war and the reasons behind it.
Yeah.
And then looking forward into the Obama administration, the amount of hope and faith that I feel like the liberal community, myself included, put into candidate Obama, to then have President Obama be just another human being who did well at some things and not well at other things, and isn't dissimilar to the amount of faith and hope that children put into their parents and parents put into their children to then have them become real, actual human beings. And to sort of look at how, you know, thinking about this coming election year, you know, when I was writing it and getting ready to make it, I always sort of knew it would be released or at least talked about in the context of an election year. And just looking at how decisions in Washington trickle down and affect people just in their homes, and wanting to make a movie that addressed politics, which not a lot of independent movies on this size and scale really do.
Especially without the story of a soldier who, I mean, you hear statistics these days about the sort of the suicide rate and everything that happens when these soldiers come home. And this is a story of like the family fallout of that, that kind of scenario.
And to just, you know, make a political movie with no politicians in it.
Nice.
I'm curious if you would make, I mean, nobody could have predicted how this election year look.
Yeah.
When you watch the finished movie now with the knowledge of like the vitriol and craziness that's gone on, do you feel like you made your statement, or do you feel like, oh God, I wish I could have had a crystal ball to see like how
I was talking to Michael Lieberman at Metrograph the other day, and he was like, it's like almost quaint to watch the movie. It's like, ah, simpler time.
I forgot what hope felt like. Yeah. And then I was like, why is this in 2008? I was like, oh, I remember being so hopeful and so excited to vote in 2008.
So it weirdly is even more of a period piece now than when I wrote it and was thinking about it. You know, when I wrote it, I was like, oh, it's like soft period. It's like basically set to in present day for all intents and purposes. We don't have to get other new cars in or anything.
Yeah, but it's really not.
But I mean, it's really, it really has, I think, become even
the discourse
more.
Which seemed contentious at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And now, seems so polite and civilized.
I really like the subtext of a lot of characters is that they're in this sort of holding pattern. They're in this stasis. You know, the brother has kind of isolated himself. He's not really interested in the outside world. The sister has confined herself to the nunnery. The parents have resorted back to like being the stoner selves. And in the meantime, the political landscape is about to change, you know, dramatically, where, you know, Obama was running on the point of change. And here these characters are trying to, like, edge forward a little, and the sister's kind of doing her best at that. I'm curious, in terms of the soldiers element of it, well, can I ask you, inspiration-wise, where was the original seed of this story?
Well, for the brother character, I'd seen a photo exhibit that I think it was Time Magazine, one of those kind of, maybe Newsweek, had done a photo series on a soldier who'd been through something similar. And there's an image in that photo series of him with his bride-to-be on their wedding day.
Oh, okay.
And it's sort of the end of The Graduate, almost. You know, it's sort of them dressed up in their finest, but not looking at each other and sort of looking off in opposite directions. And it's just, you sort of sense the fear and dread in both of them in this commitment. And that always stuck with me. You know, that image really resonated. And I think as someone who didn't fit in high school, I wouldn't say I was ostracized, but I definitely didn't have like one sort of group of people that I felt like I was a part of. It's interesting to me to sort of have a character who, like the brother, because of the way he physically looks, that he had no choice over, is sort of ostracized from normal society. And then to have his sister, who in high school made a conscious decision to ostracize herself from normal society, made a conscious decision to change her physical appearance. And it's at that point that she reappropriates that look and that persona that he can sort of start getting out of the house, that he has someone to sort of leave the house with.
Yeah.
I have a really specific relationship to that image of that soldier and his wife, because in the summer of 2007, when Hannah Takes the Stairs came out, the New York Times review of Hannah was on the same page as a publication of that photograph. And it was like such an indictment of the movie, this like frivolous little indie film. And so in many ways, that movie did okay, and it did well in New York. But, you know, being so excited for this like New York Times review of my movie, which was sort of like the first movie of mine that people were seeing, it was such a like shocking experience to be like, there's Greta and Mark Duplass. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like it's really intense. And then I was like, oh, we're cooked. I mean, how can you look at that picture and then even want to go see a movie or care at all about these like dumb, you know, artist characters who are like figuring out their life?
Well, those people are figuring out their lives too. Well, I think that's what that picture is about.
I totally agree, but it was like that image dominated, and I still can't think of the release of Hannah without like that image.
Yeah, it's really unforgettable when you see that thing. It's one of those things I saw, and I very rarely do this with like a photograph that I've seen somewhere else, but that thing hit me so hard, I like had to put it in a movie.
So, Joe, you're the executive producer on this, one of the executive producers. What made you say, I want to be involved with this film?
Well, Zach's previous work, which I was a big fan of, and also Zach's team of of Melody and Daryl and the way that the three of them have figured out how to make great movies for not much money. And so when Eddie Linker and Peter Gilbert and I started Forager with the idea of financing indie films, we really were looking for teams of filmmakers more than, you know, we needed to believe in the director mm-hmm. and the artistic vision, but we also needed to believe in a team that was going to be capable of making and delivering a movie for a specific price that we sure. agreed on. And that's so much easier said than done. And so I really had a lot of faith and confidence in this whole team that the script that we read and the movie we talked about would come to fruition mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, running off the rails halfway through or something
right,
like that.
Right.
Because we're talking about really tight margins. And so with Forager, basically, if one movie runs over, that directly hinders our ability to finance another movie. We don't have much cushion.
Right.
And so we're trying to make as many great films as we can. And that means each filmmaker really needs to deliver on the promise of the budget we all agree on. And so it was, you know, just like a really nice example of a filmmaker we wanted to support with a team that we knew could get the job done.
Nice.
Yeah. Can I ask, Melody Sisk being the other writer, well, I'm curious if you could speak to your relationship. And I'm also curious, is she uncredited as the stripper in the party, or is it?
No, she's credited as the stripper in the party.
I couldn't find her. Okay.
We credited her.
Oh, okay.
She's credited as that stripper. Yeah, so Melody and I have known each other since film school. Melody went to North Carolina School of the Arts with me. She was in the drama program and was in my little first-year five-minute movie where she plays a woman who's cheating on her husband with the Grim Reaper. it's called Left for Dead. And called her out of the blue really a couple years after graduating from school because I had a script that I thought she would really be wonderful in called Modern Love is Automatic, and she read it and loved it and really did way more for that film than just star in it, and was so invested in the life of it and in getting it out into the world that it made natural sense that she should come on board and be a producer on the next one as well as an actor in it. And we developed that story together. It was a movie called Vacation. And then she also produced the follow-up, White Reindeer, which she also appears in. And for this one, I had this little idea of a nun who used to be goth and her brother who this thing had happened to, and they're sort of stoner parents. And that was about all I knew. And as I started working on it, wasn't really coming together. Originally, she was like a country nun, and they were city parents, and there were like cheese-making scenes and that sort of thing. And Melody was like, you know what? You should come see my parents' house outside of Asheville, North Carolina. It's on the side of a mountain. And I'll take you there. We could shoot something here if you want. And I'll show you the homes and businesses of, you know, other family members or friends of family. And I took a weekend and went down there. And she showed me all these places. And they became the locations for the script.
Oh, cool.
And while we were talking about that stuff, we also started talking about our own respective families. All the characters in the family have the first names of my immediate family. I have a sister named Colleen and a brother named Jacob and a mom named Joni and a dad named Bill. And Melody's stepdad, his last name is Lunsford, so both literally and figuratively, the characters are a sort of blender of our two families, though, you know, neither of us have goth nun sisters, neither of us have war vet brothers.
But you all do love Halloween.
Yeah, no, Halloween and Christmas are my favorite holidays and always have been. I just, you know, my last movie was a Christmas movie, so it natural extension.
Yeah, I wondered, were you doing like a holiday series?
Well, if I make a Thanksgiving movie, it's a trilogy, but I don't want to make another season-specific movie because you have to make them in the season, then you have to release them in the season. And it's a little too tight. I would like a little more leeway the next time I do it. But it works because you get free production design, like a mountain in the fall is just amazing free production design.
Right.
And like the fog would just be there, you know? It's not like, you know, we didn't bring in machines that day. We would just show up and be like, well, this fog looks great. Let's shoot it.
Nice.
So yeah. And again, like the fall, the mountains, Halloween, it's just it's an evocative time of year.
Speaking of Halloween, so we're mostly a horror based podcast.
Sure.
And so I thought what spoke to me most about the movie, because it's not horror, and I rarely watch things that aren't horror. So to me, I was like, this is amazing. Other kinds of movies are great. What I really liked and what spoke to me was the outsiderness, the outsider quality of all the characters, whether it's self-imposed or just put upon them. And I wondered if you could talk to that a little bit about how you grew up, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, like I said a little bit earlier, I didn't feel ostracized in high school, but I definitely didn't feel like I belonged to any one specific group. I was like the kid who worked at the video store and was like really into John Waters movies and Herschel Gordon Lewis movies and Ray Dennis Steckler movies. And I would occasionally convince like a friend of mine to watch them with me, and they'd be like, that's crazy. And aww. I'd be like, yeah, this is what I do most of the time. Just watch Dead Alive every 2 days. And so I've always, in writing something, tended to gravitate towards characters who, for one reason or another, are sort of outside of the society that they should be existing in. Mm-hmm. In Modern Love, you know, the characters sort of, because of her emotional issues, can't really relate to people and then becomes a dominatrix as a way to sort of deal with that, and then that's not really the answer either. And then in Vacation, it's about a group of girls who take a trip and are therefore sort of X-ing themselves out of regular society and entering into the sort of, you know, beach vacation world, which exists in this surreal space in the film. And then White Reindeer, it's, you know, her grief sort of removes her from everyone who she should be able to relate to. And in this, in making a movie about family and my own experience with growing up, like, it made sense, you know? I always remember in high school, I, again, was never really a goth per se, but had a fair amount of Marilyn Manson albums and Nine Inch Nails albums.
Who didn't?
The movie starts out with the Marilyn Manson.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And just remember the day after Columbine happened, a friend of mine who was goth getting on the PA at the beginning of the day and saying, like, please don't think this is the way goth kids are. Like, we are not bad people. We do not do this. We do not support this. And it was really emotional and really powerful. And goth kids always get the short end of the stick. There's very few movies where they're treated seriously and taken seriously as characters. They are almost always either the butt of a joke in a sort of passing scene, or they're witches, you know, or they turn into werewolves. And not that some of those movies aren't good. You know, but those kids don't have a movie that says it's totally okay to be this way. You're a totally functional, wonderful, amazing, participatory member of society. And just because of the color of your lipstick and the color of your hair, it doesn't make a difference, you know?
Yeah. There's that beautiful scene in the woods with the kid who asked them if they're monsters.
Yeah.
And it speaks to the, like, just the inherent misunderstanding that, like, a monster is just someone you don't understand. It's just you're looking at them skewed, and, you know, that's both parts are playing into it.
You know, to be serious about it for a second, that's where a lot of that stuff comes from for me. And that's why it sincerely opens with the Marilyn Manson lyric. You know, that's like a sincere gesture. And the Guar song is a sincere gesture. My brother is a few years younger than me and started to get into like the Misfits and that stuff around the age that I was when I started getting into the Misfits. And I would see him every December when I would come home from college for Christmas, and his birthday was in December. And we're from the Northern Virginia area, and Guar would play a show in DC around that time every December. And I took him to his first Guar show and just said, we're going to go see a concert. You're going to have...
Oh, surprise.
Yeah. I got us some tickets. We're going to go see a show. I think you're going to...
I hope you put him in the front row.
We were close enough. I was like, I think we're going to have a fun time. And it just blew his mind. You know? And for 4 or 5 years after that, that was my regular birthday Christmas present to him, is that we would go see Guar together. So when Colleen reaches out to her brother to... with this gesture, to me, it's the most sincere gesture. It's so meaningful to me. And the choice of that band and the choice of that song is not accidental. It's 100% intentional. And to have something that says, like, which is all, you can tell dead baby jokes to each other. Like, that's what that scene is, too. Right. That scene is sort of an elaborate dead baby joke, which told by a nun. The best ones are and like that's a sincere thing on my part. Like, you can do those things and say those things and be those people and be wonderful, genuine human beings.
Yeah.
I think the Misfits are a really good, for me, representation of the sort of scary outer level hiding just what is, to me, really good pop music.
Yeah, totally.
I remember being in high school and seeing Misfits patches and t-shirts and the Devil Lock and all that stuff and being like, ooh, what is the Misfits? And then hearing it for the first time and being like, oh my God, this is like the Beach Boys. I mean, this music is so good. This is just great three-chord, like, you know, power pop.
Well,
and
for me, it was the Cramps. It was sort of discovering the Cramps the first time. In like just a record store in high school, just flipping through and being like, what the hell is this? It's amazing. And then taking it home and having, I think the nice thing about the Misfits and the Cramps is when I got into them, they not only opened up my sort of musical world, but also the cinematic world, because their songs are all so tied into film. And it'd be like, oh, what's, I wonder what this movie that this Misfits song is named after. Oh, the Cramps covered the theme song to Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. Now I need to see Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think at that age, those two things were really intertwined in a way.
Yeah, I love the soundtrack.
I was going to ask, on the note of music, working with Fritz Meyers, I guess he composed for one of your earlier films? So you had worked together before?
Music for White Reindeer and Vacation.
Okay. Is he playing drums in the movie? Who's playing drums?
Jeff Reps plays the drums.
Okay.
And Fritz wrote all those drumming pieces, just sort of programmed them out, and then Jeff came in and really knocked them out of the park. He's a professional metal drummer. He plays in many metal bands and is just like so insanely talented, which you have to be to play that kind of music. I always sort of knew that the death metal drumming was written into the script, when it would come in and when it would play as score and when it would play as the brother playing it from the other room. And again, it's just about solidifying the connection between those two characters, and sort of also the drumming in that case is narrative in a way. Mm-hmm. It is actually explaining what their connection is a little bit.
Yeah, I like to think of it like another character. Wall.
Yes. Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, and because he doesn't talk that much, and you don't even meet him until almost 30 minutes into the movie. Part of it is sort of feeling his presence before you actually see him. And the movie isn't a horror movie, but I did want it to sort of incorporate elements of horror movies, not just references to horror movies, but the notion that there is this scene where they're asked if they're monsters, and the brother is this character who has special effects makeup and who is heard before he's seen and sort of talked about before you actually get to see him, and he's sort of seen in shadow at first and is slowly brought to the front. It was not dissimilar from the way that like classical monsters are revealed.
Yeah, he's haunting the house for the first half hour. Yeah. I wondered, Jozak, if you could speak to the casting. The cast is outstanding, and I'm curious on this kind of project. That's it is an independent assembling a cast and that sort of momentum. How did that come about? Like I didn't expect to see Barbara Crampton in there.
Sure.
But there you go, and Ally Sheedy.
Yeah.
I think, so there were some people who had their roles specifically written for them. Keith, who plays the brother character, always sort of had in mind. Molly Plunk, who plays Colleen's friend Emily, who's the animal rights activist, I wrote that role specifically for her. And there are a few people who've been in previous films who had their roles specifically written for them in mind. But Addison and Allie and Barbara, we got through a pretty traditional casting process. We thought about them for the roles, or someone was like, hey, you should really look into Addison Timlin. I think she would be phenomenal for this. And watched a few of her movies and said, yeah, of course, she would be absolutely incredible.
She was really good. We know her. Well, we don't know her, but we saw her in the sort of spiritual sequel to The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Which that movie's really fun, actually.
When you watch them together, it's great.
And actually approaches a sequel remake in a pretty smart, fun way, I think.
Right.
But I watched that, and then I watched this movie, The Bounce Back, that she's in. And she's very different and very great in both of them. And she has a really powerful stillness, I think, which was really amazing for the character.
You have to call it Love and Air Sex so that people
It's called Love and Air Sex. Yeah, there's a new movie called The Bounce Back, which is not the one that she's in.
And as soon as Zach said Addison, I knew her from formerly The Bounce Back, now Love and Air Sex. And I had had a similar experience that I think you had with that movie. I saw it at South by Southwest and came out of the movie going, who is Addison Timlin? How did she walk away with every single scene she's in? Mm-hmm. She's definitely a major movie star. And so when Zach said, I mean, from our end, the script and the team need to be in place, but also that the cast needs to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically was happy to move forward as soon as Addison was involved, just because I believe in her so much as an actor. I mean, I think every time a movie of hers comes out, I'm like, all right, this will be the one where she becomes mega famous and totally unattainable and uncastable in anything other than giant budget movies.
Yeah, yeah. Man, this one maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, I mean, Allie, the same thing, sent her the script and she loved it immediately. And within 2 days of sending the script to her, she was totally committed to the project, and we were buying her a plane ticket, and she was on her way to Asheville to shoot the scenes.
The scenes with the two of them are really touching, because they're both listening actors.
Yes.
They're both listeners so well.
Yeah, they're phenomenal. And then Barbara, I've always been a fan of. You know, I grew up on Reanimator and grew up on From Beyond, and always loved her work in those two films. And then she was in my friend Ted Gagan's movie, We Are Still Here.
Yeah.
And I had just done trivia with Ted at Oscilloscope and was thinking about who could play this part. And Barbara came to mind, and I had Ted introduce me to her over email. And again, just sent her the script, and she read it quickly and loved it quickly and said yes. And is the literally nicest person I've ever met in the entire world.
Totally.
There's no nicer woman.
That's really nice to hear.
She played my mom in Your Next, which was really... I remember landing in... We shot that movie in Columbia, Missouri, but I remember landing at the airport in St. Louis to drive out to Columbia and being so geeky and starstruck by her and feeling like a little intimidated. And then she was so nice.
So nice.
And I don't know how she does that.
Mindy and I are enormous fans of Your Next.
She's awesome. Oh, great.
Yeah, we love Your Next. And I have to, I'm a nerd, whatever. I have to talk about The Sacrament a little bit with you, because it's one of my most favorite movies.
Awesome.
And so I just wondered, how was it filming? How was the filming process for that?
Really fun. I mean, on my end, when I get to act in somebody else's movie, it's such a vacation from having to be a director and producer and deal with all the stress. I'm like, great, I get a piece of paper with call times, and then I just get to act all day and go home. Perfect. And we shot in Savannah, outside of Savannah. And, I personally was really obsessed with Jonestown and Jim Jones, and believed him to be, before he went nuts, a really radical activist and a really interesting person. And so when Ty first called me, before I was in the movie, just, you know, Ty and I are friends, so often we're sort of like pitching each other ideas before they become scripts or movies. And he was like, I'm thinking about this thing that's sort of like modeled on Jonestown. We got into this really deep conversation about Jim Jones and all that stuff. And so when he asked me to be in it, I was like, yes, 100%. Yeah. And then he built Jonestown, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we found this big empty field, and basically the production designer spent a long time and a lot of money reconstructing something very similar to how Jonestown felt. So it was a really surreal experience getting there and walking into that field and being like, wow, this is probably a lot
like
what it must have felt to arrive there in Guyana and see it for the first time. And so it was a really cool experience for me. And, you know, it's just like working with friends is always really fun, because I'd worked with A.J. Bone a couple times, Kate Scheel and Amy Simetz and Kentucker.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a really fun group experience of having fun shooting during the day, but also fun hanging out with all those people.
Nice.
Cool. Zach, can I ask you, working with Keith Paulson, considering the extensive prosthesis and the face makeup of a, you know, a traumatic burn victim, so much of his performance is kind of like reduced to body language. I'm curious if you could talk about
directing him, and I imagine that presents a challenge. That like he almost literally doesn't have his face to use.
Yeah,
in
and
his
he's
performance.
Wearing sunglasses for most of the movie too, so he doesn't have his eyes either. Keith has a very specific, amazing voice, which I've always loved hearing in movies coming out of Keith's face, and Keith's face in other movies is pretty good too. Yeah, I mean, I've always really liked Keith's work and really liked Keith's screen presence, and sort of from the get-go thought that his demeanor and what's specific about him and what makes him special as an actor and as a screen presence would work really well in here, because he does have a very sort of wry sense of humor, and does play deadpan incredibly well and really understands that.
Yeah.
But I think also has way more chops than most other roles give him the ability to act upon. And so it just seemed like a cool opportunity. And he's a friend of mine, and it also seemed like I should probably have someone I already knew and was friendly with be the guy that I made sit in a makeup chair for that long every day.
Someone that would forgive you.
Yeah. But it was also more convenient for Keith to put the makeup on and take the makeup off at housing. He was staying in an apartment with the guy who did all the makeup.
Okay.
So they would wake up in the morning, put the makeup on, drive to set, and then when the day was done, they would drive home from set with Keith still in the makeup.
That is a long
and
they
day. Would take it back off at their apartment. So that's what Keith looked like to me for most of the shoot. And well, that's what he looked like to everyone else. So I think that helped him.
Yeah.
And I think that also really helped everyone else in making the movie, that like, that's how we interacted and responded with him, was in that makeup.
At what point
did
you realize that was having a positive psychological effect?
In retrospect, I think. I mean, when I was making the movie, I was too busy trying to make our days to like realize anything.
Well, you had such a reverence for Keith as well.
Sure. Yes.
But it was really amazing to hear that Peter only really knew him in that makeup and was saying at the Q&A on Friday that he walked past Keith and didn't recognize him.
Oh, wow.
Because he had only seen him maybe once before.
Yeah, same thing with Allie at the BAM screening.
It's incredible. Oh, wow.
Did not know that was
they just know him via his voice, really.
Yeah. Wow.
Meeting at the rap party for the first time.
Yeah. You're like, who are you, stranger?
Yeah. Adam gave us the wrap-up sign. So, Joe, Zach, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We'll fill out the details on our end, but Little Sister is coming to digital distribution in theaters.
It's in theaters and on VOD right now. If you go to littlesisterthemovie.com, you can find out all the different ways you can see
Perfect.
It.
Perfect. Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
As always, you can find us online at therantsmacabre.com, and our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram are @rantsmacabre. Drop us a line. We love hearing from you guys, and definitely we're always eager to hear movie recommendations, and we might even throw them into the Lunch Hour Review series. So, be in touch. For added content, we've also got a Patreon page where you can kick in a couple bucks, and for that you get an entire library of bonus content, including extra episodes, movie watch-alongs, and sketches that we write and do relative to the movies that we're covering that particular week. That's it.
You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.